Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places. Welcome to Forward Thinking.
Welcome to Forward Thinking, the audio podcast where we talk about the future and the things we need to take into consideration, because, of course, the future is where we will spend the rest of our lives. I'm Jonathan Strickland.
I'm Lauren Vogelbaum.
And I'm Joe McCormick. And future events such as these will concern you in the future.
That's right. That's right. We're just going to quote Ed Wood movies for the rest of this episode. Actually, that's not true. We're going to talk about energy and electricity and waste and ways that we can be smarter about generating electricity and hopefully managing the waste problem that we have while trying to create electricity. In a previous episode, we talked about fusion, which is where you fuse two light atoms together, and in the process, you release quite a bit of energy in the form of heat, which then turns water into steam, and that steam then turns steam turbines, which then, connected to electrical generators, creates electricity.
Right.
Yay.
Yeah.
Yay.
But, right, which is a lot more efficient than anything that we have today, like nuclear fission.
Right. If we can get fusion to work. See, that's the problem. Is that we have to make sure that the reactions themselves are giving off enough energy that it's more than what was required for us to get that reaction started in the first place. That's right. Where we're kind of hitting the wall right now.
We don't know for sure that we can do that. So fusion is a great possibility, and I think it's an excellent place to do research, but we shouldn't put all our eggs in one basket.
Yes, don't put all your electro eggs in one energy basket, as I said.
Right, because that could be a big problem. Think about this. I mean, imagine that even if we are able to get a positive energy gain factor in a fusion reactor within 100 years, there's no guarantee that we'll make it that long unless we look at other
alternate forms of
right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So fusion may not work at all, which means that we need to look into alternatives anyway. Mm-hmm. And if it does work, it may be decades
We still
off.
Have to get there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So either way, looking into alternatives where we maximize our production of electricity, which is really what we're talking about here, and we minimize the waste, that's going to be important, because we don't, if in 100 years we get fusion but the world is not really a livable space anymore, mm-hmm. it's not going to be so pleasant for the human race anyway. So we have to look into these alternatives.
Well, Jonathan, I like the way you put that with in terms of maximizing and minimizing, because I think a lot of the innovations that are going to get us into the future aren't just, crazy new ideas that nobody's ever heard of before, like a completely out of left field new technology.
Sure.
A lot of it is just going to be finding smarter, more efficient ways to do the things we already do.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
Looking for energy where we can find it.
And I mean, we've got lots of examples of this in things like, the improvement of efficiency in wind turbines and solar farms. But those have been talked about a lot.
Mm-hmm. Ad nauseum.
Yeah.
And one of the basic problems with creating energy is that we don't have an infinite supply of coal or oil or uranium or any of the other things that we're currently using to produce it.
Right. And just in case anyone wants to write in and yell.
Yeah.
Creating electricity. We know that energy can neither be created nor destroyed.
Yes.
We can only convert mass into energy, which is still not creating it. It's just a transformation.
Take it up with Einstein.
Yeah, yeah. I obey the laws of physics, all right? So don't send them after me. But one of the things that Joe found out when he was researching this episode, I mean, Joe wrote the video episode about energy, and you discovered an interesting approach to making nuclear fission reactions more efficient, because that's one of the problems with nuclear fission.
Right. Well, so we've had nuclear fission for years and years.
Yeah.
But there are a lot of problems with it. It creates really, really toxic nuclear waste that you have to protect. You got to lock it up in graphite mm-hmm. beams and bury it underground. And,
yeah, under a mountain. Yeah.
Right. It's all so dangerous that it's technically as soon as it's created, it belongs to the government. It belongs to the Department of Energy.
Yeah. That's exactly who I want to have access to all the most dangerous things in the world.
Right. And then there's the fact that we're not really getting all of the energy that we can out of these fuel rods. I mean, so what do you use to cause a reaction in a fission reactor? In your standard nuclear power plant, you have fuel rods that are full of tiny uranium pellets.
Yeah, refined uranium.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not just
highly
not just,
enriched. Yeah,
yeah. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
That you use to you set off a reaction in them, and that creates a fission reaction that releases a lot of energy, heats water, and creates your electricity.
Right.
The problems we've said so far. Waste, not the most efficient reaction. Also, there's a big danger, as we learned from the Fukushima incident during the
sure.
earthquake.
And Chernobyl as
and
well.
And Chernobyl mm-hmm. and
Three Mile Island, although right. that wasn't the meltdown. But
yeah. But so these reactors are potentially very dangerous. You have to be extremely careful with them.
Sure.
Is there a way to get around this?
And that's where the waste annihilating molten salt reactor from Transatomic comes in.
It's a cool name.
Yeah, it just rolls off the tongue, as I yeah. said in the episode. Yeah, I like to call it WAMSR.
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 Yeah. Yeah, WAMSR, waste annihilating molten salt reactor.
I don't know, then
WAMSR.
You don't get to say annihilating, and annihilating.
Annihilating.
Is such a
yeah, well, I say that so frequently in my daily life. But yeah, the idea here is to try and maximize that efficiency. Mm-hmm. And in fact, Transatomic claims on their website that the conventional nuclear reactors that use fission reactions only capture about 3% of the potential fission energy in a given amount of uranium before the uranium has to be removed from the reactor, or else you're in danger of a meltdown.
Right.
Their design, again, the company claims, will capture 98% of the remaining energy that would have otherwise been lost.
That's pretty wicked.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's incredibly more efficient, if that in fact yeah. is true.
If you buy their claim.
Yeah.
Right.
But it combines several existing technologies, right?
Sure.
It, so the waste annihilating molten salt reactor, it uses this this molten salt. You might ask, what is molten salt? Well, you don't usually encounter molten salt in your day-to-day life. But
no.
but in this case, it's not molten salt doesn't like become the fuel or something like that. Molten salt is what this reactor uses to manage its heat.
Yeah. As you are using the uranium in that initial fission reaction, mm-hmm. you are getting nuclear waste as a result. You dissolve the nuclear waste, or rather Transatomic would dissolve the nuclear waste within this molten salt, which manages the heat.
Mm-hmm.
And it means that, if you want to really simplify it, it means that the reactor can safely maintain the temperature it needs to continue to turn water into steam to turn those steam turbines and generate electricity. So you are really extending the useful life out of that uranium.
Yeah.
And as a result, less of the uranium is left behind. And uranium, that's the radioactive material that is so dangerous.
Less mm-hmm. nuclear waste at the mm-hmm. end.
Yeah, the or at least less radioactive waste. I mean, however you want to define it, it's going to be less radioactive waste. And from the estimates I saw, it reduces the amount of time where this radioactive waste is dangerous from the thousands of years to around 300 years. Still longer than anyone's comfortable lifespan, obviously.
Sure.
But it's a huge difference from this. You know, it won't yeah. be safe to go near for 10,000 years.
Because marking that barrel is difficult.
Well, it also means that if you're able to build these reactors, then there's the potential of taking nuclear waste that has already been generated mm-hmm. and using that as a fuel.
Which there are tons and tons of just kind of lying about, really. I mean,
well, I hope it's a little
a
less casual
thought.
Than that. Yeah. I'm thinking about some cities I visited where I thought barrels of nuclear waste would not seem out of place, but I would like to think that they are mostly confined in fairly secure.
According to the documentary Duke Nukem, they
okay, that's fair. Yeah, according to Duke Nukem, they are a tasty shake. Yeah, and something else that I thought was interesting, this is just sort of an aside, is that the company has three founders. Two of them are MIT students, and the third is Russ Wilcox, who is the former CEO of E-Ink. And I never would have thought of electronic ink and nuclear fission going hand in hand. But it's interesting because, you know, E-Ink is all about efficiency, too. It's this idea of you create a state of the ink, so it's displaying either a neutral side or a dark side to the screen, and it maintains that until you change the state of the electrostatic field, which means that, you know,
that
once
you
establish
reuse.
It, yeah, mm-hmm. you establish it and it stays that way. That's why if you're using an e-reader, it's not using energy until you turn the page.
Mm-hmm.
So in between page turns, that's why those batteries last forever, because mm-hmm. it's not using a lot of electricity. So in that case, that's the only thing I can think of that's similar between the two.
But so this isn't a new idea, I don't think. I think that they were first proposed to power bombers, and one was operated back in the 60s and 70s at Oak Ridge National Labs.
Yeah.
So it's been around for a minute, but just, you know, not in a...
There are newer and better designs, I think.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, because, again, if it's one of those things where it's a modest increase in efficiency, it may not be worth the expense of
toting around uranium.
Either designing and building a reactor or refitting existing reactors to be able to use this sort of methodology. Have to demonstrate that it's of an incredible value before that becomes, you know, economically feasible.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and as we mentioned before, part of the value also of a molten salt reactor is that they say that it is much less vulnerable to meltdown.
Right.
Right, right, yeah. It would stop the reactor. It wouldn't have the potential to explode the way that...
Yeah, or essentially it wouldn't have the potential for the uranium to reach a temperature that the reactor itself would be unable to contain.
Right.
That's generally, I mean... the idea that I get from it. So so it's got good potential, and you know, it cuts down on waste.
Mm-hmm.
So we wanted to talk about another kind of technology.
Yeah, this isn't the only technology like this, right? That
right.
both cuts down on waste and gets something back out of it.
Yeah. So so what you're referring to, I assume, is plasma gasification,
which also sounds really cool.
Yeah,
these things have great
converters.
Names.
Plasma waste converters. All right. You know, I write for HowStuffWorks.com, and one of the very first articles I wrote was about how plasma waste converters work. And as a result, I got to actually go and speak with some of the thought leaders in plasma waste converters.
Oh, cool.
I got to watch footage. I actually, somewhere I have a piece of slag from a plasma waste converter reaction.
You might want to explain what slag is.
Yeah, I will. So all right. So plasma waste converters are all designed to get rid of garbage and convert it into one of two things. Anything that is non-organic, meaning it is not carbon-based, gets liquefied. All right, this liquid stuff ends up being inert, so there's not anything toxic about it.
Mm-hmm.
And when it cools, you know, either if you cool it by air, then it turns into this kind of rocky substance that looks like obsidian or volcanic glass, and that's the slag. If you cool it in water, by the way, it beads up into little pebbles. And if you run compressed air through it, which I got to see a video of, and boy, was that terrifying, because it was actually a dude with a hose of compressed air standing next to a stream of molten slag. I mean, it looks like lava
sure.
It looks like.
Yeah.
This molten slag's pouring out of a spigot, and he's blowing compressed air through it, making these strands of slag, which when they cool through the air become this sort of fluffy substance that apparently is incredibly efficient as an insulator. And it also floats on water, and it soaks up oil. So you could even use this to help soak up oil in an oil spill if you wanted to. It's what was it called? Rock wool. That's it.
Wow.
It's all coming back to me. It's been years since I've written this article. But anyway.
So this sounds great. I mean, why don't we have these on every street corner?
Well, before I even get there, I haven't even gotten to the really cool part yet.
Well, I want to know what creates the heat that liquefies this
Well,
stuff.
I haven't gotten to that yet
okay,
either.
Okay.
All right.
Just go, Jonathan.
I got to talk about the other half.
Okay,
I just
go.
Said the non-organic. What about the organic? That's the question you should be asking.
What
We're
about
full
the
of
organic?
Questions.
Okay, here's what happens to the organic stuff. Anything that's carbon-based gasifies, so it turns
Whoa.
Into a gas. That's
yeah.
because the incredible amount of energy you are applying to this stuff in the form of heat turns it almost instantaneously into gas. Now, that gas you can then put through chemical scrubbers. You have to cool it down first. You put it through a cooling system so the gas – because the gas is incredibly hot when it first goes through the system. You cool it down, and in that process, you can actually capture some of that heat and turn water into steam and generate electricity that way. But you can also scrub it with other chemicals, removing some of the harmful elements out of it, making it inert. And the rest of what you have left is a synthetic gas that can be used as fuel. So those are your two outcomes is gas that can be used as fuel and inert slag. Cool stuff. So what makes this heat is a plasma torch.
Mm.
And so plasma is an ionized gas. It's a gas with free roaming ions. So that means electrons are also free roaming in this gas. It burns at an incredible temperature. We're talking like surface of the sun or hotter.
At 10,000 degrees, something like that?
Something like that, yeah. And at that temperature, you're breaking those chemical bonds, and that's what's making everything either melt or gasify. Again, depending upon what it's made out of. So you have to provide energy to the plasma torch so it will maintain this plasma field, this very hot field. And that's what, you know, that's what makes this thing go. You use the cooling system around the reactor, which again can capture off that heat and use that to help generate electricity. And assuming you have enough carbon material in the garbage that you're processing, you can create enough synthetic gas to act as fuel to run the whole system. And even potentially, if you have enough of it, sell electricity back to the grid. So you would actually be generating electricity by not really burning, but processing garbage.
Mm-hmm.
It also has a couple of other phases. You usually would have a phase where you try to retrieve any metal before going through this system. So, because, you know, metal you could actually recycle into other stuff, and otherwise it's just going to melt down.
Mm-hmm.
So you would try and have to sort the garbage first, and you usually grind the stuff up. You've got some heavy grinders that grind everything up into little pieces before it gets exposed to the plasma torch, because then you've really cut down on all that surface area and make it a lot easier to process it. And the reason why they aren't everywhere, Lauren, to get to your question, now that I've answered Joe's question about how it does this, is because it would be very expensive to build these things, all right? So building a plant is expensive. You could co-locate it at a dump, essentially, like any place where there's a landfill.
Yeah.
You could put it at the landfill. I mean, there it is right there next to its fuel source. And in fact, most of the figures I saw was that once you get to a certain size of a facility for a plasma waste converter plant, you would be able to not only take in all the garbage that was coming in from a community, but in fact start to mine any existing landfills. So in other words, you would take care of the garbage problem and remove the landfills eventually. Over several decades worth of time, the landfills would get smaller and smaller until you had reclaimed them, and then the plasma waste facility would just take in incoming garbage. And it wouldn't produce as much energy at that point, obviously, because you know, part of its fuel supply is gone. But in a way, that's a good problem to have because it's taken away this environmental concern that we have.
Right, right.
So, and in addition to this usable gas that you get from it that you can burn, the slag is also useful, right?
Yeah, you can use it as aggregate. You can use it in building materials.
Right.
You can use it to freak out your coworkers if you like. I had a small sample of this inside a plastic box. And one of our former coworkers, his name's John Fuller, he sat next to me in our cubicles. And I had this little, you know, clear plastic box that had this piece of what looked like volcanic rock in it. And he picked it up one day and he was looking at the box. And I said, yeah, it's slag from a plasma waste converter. I got it when I was interviewing the guy who thought this idea up. He says, oh, that's so cool. And he pops the top of it off and puts the rock in his hand. I'm like, oh. Oh, no. He's like, what? Like, oh, no, I got to make some calls. Like, oh, no. And he started freaking out. Like, no, I'm just kidding you. But, yeah, for a while there, he thought that he had accidentally unleashed the zombie plague.
Yeah.
Poor John Fuller.
Yeah.
He opened the Hellraiser box.
John has moved on to bigger and better things where hopefully his coworkers don't make him think that he's created the zombie apocalypse. I just couldn't resist. The other thing I should mention is that plasma waste converters are not the solution to all of our energy problems. They could help offset energy production, but wouldn't be producing enough electricity to replace things like, you know, fossil fuels or solar plants or anything like that. It just would help.
Of course not, but the point I think we're making here is that every little bit actually does help.
Yeah, and it also ends up impacting another unrelated problem.
Yeah,
right?
The environmental issues some of the detractors of it have said that, well, what if we have these everywhere and then nobody recycles? And I think that that's kind of missing the scope of the point.
Right, if nobody recycles, but the recycling thing, yeah, that's a weird argument. I can't imagine why you would make that. Like,
I'm not sure.
I guess maybe people in Portland.
Well, no, I don't know the economics
of
it. There may be a reason why recycling is important. Like, if you want to, obviously, if you're converting all these different things to just slag and gas, there may be materials that we want to keep in quantity.
If there are, recycling would be important for any material that requires a great deal of energy for us to access or convert into whatever it is we use. So, for example, glass, not a problem. Glass is made out of sand.
We have sand.
Sand and heat. And that's easy to do. So glass, actually, I've heard lots of arguments saying that recycling glass actually doesn't make that much sense because the amount of energy needed to recycle the glass is greater than it would be to create new glass. So the better thing to do with glass is not just use it and throw it away, but to reuse.
Right.
Because we hear about reuse and recycle. This mm-hmm. would be a case for reusing. But things like plastics, that's different. You know, or aluminum would be different too. So, but again, the facility would separate some stuff out already. So it probably would not remove the necessity for recycling completely, but it would reduce the importance of it. But we don't have them, so it's kind of a moot point. I mean, there's only a few facilities like this that exist in the world. They do exist. It's not like this is just in theory. There are mm-hmm. actual plasma waste converters out there. There's just only a few of them.
You know, one of the funny things that happens when you start thinking about energy and efficiency is you can look around the world and you can just see that energy is wasted everywhere. And
sure.
I'm not talking about just leaving the lights on, the kinds of ways that we normally think about wasting energy. I'm talking about what happens to the energy, the impact energy, when you put your foot down on the floor,
right,
and you take a step?
Yeah, you're not.
You press the keys on your computer, you know.
Right, you're not doing any useful work there. Mm-hmm. Like you're not like things that are actually an expense of energy aren't being recaptured in any meaningful way. And so what if you could find a way to capture that energy so that all these little things we do throughout the day, but everyone pretty much does them.
Mm-hmm.
What if we could recapture that energy and put it to, you know, some other use, like creating electricity?
Right. As people have already thought of doing this kind of thing in cars, right, when you have, like, regenerative braking.
Sure.
Oil. So mm-hmm. the brakes used to just – it was just wasted energy.
Just friction and heat. And that's mm-hmm. all – you would lose all that energy.
Yeah, just going out the window. But if you have regenerative braking – the car manufacturers figured out, we can actually reclaim some of that energy and use it for something.
Right, which means that you extend the battery life of an electric car, for example.
Right.
So it's not that you're recapturing all the energy that you just used. You can't do that. You're losing some no matter what.
Right.
Because
entropy holds.
Yeah, but you can at least extend the battery life that way by having regenerative braking.
Mm-hmm.
So what if we could do that with ourselves? Like, what if we could end up doing it where either we have something that's lining the floors or even in our shoes that could capture this energy? And you found something that was kind of interesting that all has to do with a virus?
Yeah. There's a phenomenon, piezo or piezoelectricity.
Yeah, I call it piezoelectric and everyone else calls it piezoelectric.
I call it piezo.
But you know what?
But Jonathan's smarter than me, so.
I call it piezo.
I'm just
pie electric. I think this could really catch on. Yes.
Electric pie does sound delicious and zappy.
So,
but anyway, I probably pronounced it incorrectly, but I'm stubborn and I shall continue to do so.
Well go for it.
Whatever it really is, piezoelectric energy comes from pressure, right?
Right.
So anytime you apply pressure to something, there is some kind of energy transfer going on there. And what if we can harness that energy? Well, it turns out there are ways to do this. In fact, I think, you know, just like scales and stuff like that use this.
And you know, if you look at a timepiece that uses a quartz crystal,
yeah.
That's piezoelectric or piezoelectric.
Right.
It's a material that when you compress it, it emits electricity,
exactly.
Essentially. Or if you induce electricity, if you give it electricity, it then vibrates.
Right.
So it's that relationship there.
Right. It's a relationship between
mechanical stress and electricity.
Yes.
Exactly.
Very good. Thank you, Lauren.
Exactly.
For making my stumbling actually sound smart.
So you can imagine that, if we could put these generators just everywhere that there's wasted friction, you know, if you put them on stairs or on the soles of your feet,
right,
or something like this, could you reclaim over time the energy costs that it would cost to create them?
Right.
And could you even get a surplus? And so say I want to put piezo electric fields on the bottom of my shoes, walk around all day and charge my iPod.
Right.
Well, it turns out that you might be able to do something like that. Now, but part of the problem is creating these things, we haven't reached peak efficiency yet.
Right.
So at this point, in a lot of cases, it would probably cost more to create one of these and it wouldn't put off enough electricity, but we're getting better. Also, they tend to involve materials that you don't want to put into consumer electronics.
Right.
Like lead and stuff like that.
Yeah, things that are
generally
toxic.
Yeah, not good.
But the lab that we were looking at figured out a way that you could create a small ocean of viruses.
Right.
Viruses that don't affect humans. They're bacteriophage viruses.
So they attack bacteria, not people.
Right. Mm-hmm. And so they wouldn't be harmful to you. They're the kind of viruses that eat the bacteria that's all over the sidewalk, you know, and everywhere.
M13 specifically is the bacteriophage designation.
Oh, wow. M13, yeah. That's I remember that now. It sounds like a British Secret Service kind
of. It does.
Oh, but,
it's way behind M5.
But yeah, so anyway, you can use viruses to generate electricity. They found out you can make a little ocean of these, and when you slap it, they put off electric current.
So you connect that, or you coat an electrode in
exactly.
this stuff.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And every time you apply pressure, compression to that electrode, then a little bit of electricity passes through it. And accumulatively, this starts to matter. So, mm-hmm. I mean, if
right, yeah. It's when you push it once, I think. I was reading up on it, and it only produces maybe a quarter of the voltage of a AAA battery.
Right.
Which doesn't sound a lot until you consider the fact that you just made viruses into energy.
Right. And if you're doing lots of steps, if you're walking a lot and you have these in your shoes, then obviously you're going to generate more electricity. Or if you have this as part of a heavily trafficked area, then you could harness electricity. I mean, you could even, in theory, create a highway system in the future that would use something along these lines that could, through the amount of pressure being applied to it when cars are passing over, start to reclaim some of that energy.
Yeah, if you could paint this film onto a street, then.
Exactly, yeah. We don't know where it would be efficient in the future to use things like this. So in fact, we don't even know for sure if we can get there, but it's really cool to try.
Yeah. The nice thing about discovering things like this is that even if ultimately it turns out that your initial discovery is not applicable in any meaningful way, you can learn other things during that process that end up informing other processes. So you make other things more efficient. Even if your initial approach ends up being a bust, you may find other things that help you out in ways that you had not intended when you started out, which is why I love science. I love the idea, and I don't think of science as having – you'll hear about a scientific study where you're thinking, like, what's the practical application of this study?
Oh, yeah, and, pure science versus technology.
And I think that's the wrong question to ask, because – if we only concentrated on things that we thought were going to have a practical outcome, we would be so far behind where we are today.
Oh, yeah.
Today's pure science is tomorrow's technology.
That's right.
I mean, it's ridiculous.
Who
would have thought that quantum mechanics would ever have a technological application? You know, 100 years ago when people were talking about what these strange quantum states. But now we're talking about quantum computers and quantum encryption. And
Yeah. There's definitely some emerging technology today that came out of pure science from 100 years ago. And maybe in another 100 or 200 years, we'll be saying the same thing about something like string theory, where right now we don't even call that a science. We almost call it a philosophy because there's no way to test it or observe
exactly.
it. But who knows? Maybe in 100 or 200 years, that will be the genesis of something that really changes the world, like the Genesis Project, which is documented in Star Trek II: Wrath of Khan. All right, well, let's wrap this up. This was a good discussion about and you know, these were just three examples of some of the ways people have found
a million ways, other things like this.
Yeah.
To maximize that electricity generation while minimizing waste. And it's really cool application of ingenuity and technology. I really think that this is pretty amazing stuff. If you guys have suggestions for future topics for us to cover, I highly recommend you go to our website. It's fwthinking.com. There you can watch the video series, you can listen to this podcast, you can read the blogs, and you can also connect with us on our various social platforms like Facebook, Twitter, and Google+. And we will talk to you again really soon.
For more on this topic and the future of technology, visit forwardthinking.com. brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places.